Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan called President Trump's first speech to Congress last night a home run. In his inaugural address, Trump painted a dark picture of America. Last night, the president reiterated many of his America First campaign themes, but he also struck a softer tone and urged Americans to dream.
The time for small thinking is over. The time for trivial fights is behind us. We just need the courage to share the dreams that fill our hearts.
Well, there was some murmuring at that moment as Trump gestured to the Democratic side of the aisle. Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the speech had an air of unreality because what Trump said was so different from how he's governed his first month in office. Congressman Steve Cohen is a Democrat who represents Tennessee's 9th District, which includes Memphis. Congressman, welcome to Here and Now.
Good to be with you.
Some are calling it Mr. Trump's most successful, most presidential address yet. What did you hear?
Well, indeed it was, because he hasn't had a successful or presidential address to date. So no matter what he did, it would be better than what had been seen, we'd seen in the previous 39 or 40 days. I think it was staged well. I think it was written to appeal to America's some hopes and a lot of fears. And I think he read it properly. But was there any sincerity to it? Was there any reality to it? No. And when he talked about, and he was pointing to the Democrats, time to get beyond trivial things and small disagreements. Sounded good, sounded like he was being a president, but what were those things? Those things were things like his campaign's connections with Russian intelligence who hacked the election and committed, if correctly and accurately proven, treasonous acts. And it relates to his income taxes, which he won't release for reasons that I think relate to his investments and possible connections to Russian investors. Those are not trivial things. Those are fundamental to democracy and fundamental to America being having a system of elections that are fair and above board and not influenced by the Russians and not having a president who is subservient to the Russians.
He did not talk about Russia or the conflict in Syria, but he did talk about getting paid family leave and an infrastructure package worth $1 trillion. Are you ready to work with him on those two big issues?
Indeed, it depends how he funds them. We've been for, the Democrats have been for a large infrastructure package for years. We need to fund it properly and correctly and not depend on toll roads and private bond issues, which will not work. And we need to have family medical leave. That's been a long-time Democratic position. We'll see how he implements it. Who knows what he'll do. And as far as tax credits, which he likes to use, they benefit the wealthy more than they do the middle class or other folks. And that's the same thing with tax cuts. He said we're going to have a big middle class, gigantic middle class tax cut. He talks about the middle class. It's not for the middle class. It's for the wealthy.
Congressman, the president began his speech calling for tolerance. He condemned hate crimes against Jews and the murder of an Indian engineer in Kansas. Let's take a listen.
Recent threats targeting Jewish community centers and vandalism of Jewish cemeteries, as well as last week's shooting in Kansas City, remind us that while we may be a nation divided on policies, we are a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil in all of its very ugly forms.
Congressman, what did you think when you heard that?
Well, I thought it was interesting that he started with that, and he talked about the end of Black History Month, which it was. It's something he should have done, and he should have done earlier. He should have recognized the incidents that have at the Jewish community centers where there have been threats called in, and particularly at the cemeteries in St. Louis and Philadelphia where hundreds of gravestones were pushed over, and they were heavy gravestones. I don't know how that was done and who would have been involved in it, but that should have been immediately called out, and it took him a long time to get around to doing it. Whoever wrote a speech understood his failures of the last 30 days in tone and in lack of presidential vision and leadership and tried to rectify them. But he didn't call for any action. He said that they were wrong and we were against that. Well, that's good and true, but he didn't call for any action against, and he didn't call for any redoubling of efforts. You know, Black History Month, and you've got an attorney general who is not for supportive of voting rights extensions and never been for civil rights. We're going to have a whole lot of black history, but are we going to have anything in the present and the future that help black people get opportunity, get a chance to live the American dream and to vote without intimidation? Not with this attorney general. We give them an opportunity to get education in public schools, not with the Secretary of Education that we have. So, yeah, the rhetoric was better. The tone was moderate. But when you look at the speech, there was no substance. There were so many areas. And when you talk about funding defense, that means you're not going to fund and you're going to cut programs like food stamps and LIHEAP, which helps people with energy bills, and WIC payments for mothers and pregnant mothers. And that's cruel. And those are safety net programs that are essential services that need to be maintained. And he doesn't want to maintain them and won't. So for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The laws of Newton said that there was a lot missing last night.
Congressman Steve Cohen is a Democrat who represents Tennessee's 9th Congressional District. Thank you, Congressman.
You're welcome.
And joining us now is Domenico Montanaro, NPR's lead political editor. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
So you heard Steve Cohen there say the rhetoric was better, the tone was moderate. Overall, it sounds like this speech is getting pretty good reviews, but it was a very different kind of President Trump than we've seen over the last few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, stylistically, certainly this is a speech that was maybe his most organized and scripted speech that he's ever given, which is an important thing for him, especially when most of his supporters would like to see him be, quote, more presidential and not get into kind of Twitter wars and things like that. So he was able to do that. He was able to kind of hit a reset button with a lot of Republicans in Congress. Congressman Cohen is correct, though, when he says that there really weren't a lot of policy details. So it wasn't very soaring rhetorically. It didn't reach for, you know, a shining city on a hill that with an arc of history that bends toward justice, to mix Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama. But it also wasn't a laundry list and prescriptive. So what was it? You know, and it was something that was able at least to be something of a reset button to show that he can do this and stay within the bounds of a framework. That's for sure.
Well, and when it comes to the policy specifics, is he going to have support in a Republican Congress for spending a lot more money on things like infrastructure and the military if that means adding to the national debt?
You know, they always say the devil's in the details. And I think that that's when it becomes more difficult. It becomes more complicated. He has a tremendous advantage right now, and that is the fact that Republicans are in power everywhere. The only thing that they don't have is 60 votes in the Senate to overcome a filibuster. But, you know, anytime anything big has ever gotten done in American history, it's because of numbers. Lyndon Johnson's Great Society wouldn't have gotten passed if Lyndon Johnson wasn't a Southern Democrat and could get those Southern Democrats on board. You know, health care wouldn't have passed under Barack Obama if they didn't have 60 votes in the Senate. So they were able to, you're able to get these things through when you have support and you have power. Republicans have that kind of power at lower levels too. Think about governorships and state legislatures. So they have all of those things lined up. So Donald Trump actually has quite a bit of room for error. Republicans like Mitch McConnell and the Republican majority leader in the Senate and Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, just hope that that error isn't too big.
Well, and we did hear Mitch McConnell yesterday say he is not in favor of something that's been talked about, which is proposed cuts to foreign aid at the State Department. Senator Lindsey Graham also spoke yesterday to NBC News about that. Here he is.
It's dead on arrival. It's not going to happen. It would be a disaster. If you take soft power off the table, then you're never going to win the war.
So again, the question, Domenico, is the agenda of the Republican Congress really the same as President Trump's agenda?
Largely, they are on board with almost everything. And if Trump leaves most of the legislating to McConnell and Ryan and then says at the end of the day, hey, it's about compromise, we won, we got something done, then you could see a big signing ceremony and him claiming victory and moving on, which is a lot of what's likely to happen. You know, there are certain players within the White House, Steve Bannon being one, who would like to see the president pass a big infrastructure bill to be able to still win over those working class whites in the Midwest who gave him this chance when they had been voting Democratic in past years, and they think that that's an avenue for them to be able to win re-election. So that's a big priority, and Republicans have always believed that infrastructure is something that should get done, but they could never agree with Democrats on how to pay for it, and we're going to see now if they're actually going to be able to try to pay for it when it comes to what Donald Trump wants to do.
So, Domenico, there was an expectation that we were going to get the new travel ban executive order from the White House today. And now there's a storyline that's out there that maybe they've delayed that because they're getting such good reviews on this speech. Is that possible? And for something that President Trump has said is so important in national security, would he delay it because of good reviews from a speech?
There's been reporting on that. One of CNN's reporters quoted a White House official anonymously. Amazing. I didn't think they liked
anonymous
sources.
They're not supposed to do that,
sources.
Right, yeah.
But they quoted a White House official who essentially said that that wasn't the full calculation, but that's certainly part of it, that they want to give the executive order its moment. So not necessarily to say that that the good reviews are what pushed it, but at the same time, if he'd gotten bad reviews, it's typical political strategery, to speak, to say, let's change the subject
with something
and
else.
Let's get this other thing out there.
That's Domenico Montanaro, lead political editor at NPR. Thanks so much, as always.
Hey, thank you.
This time of year tends to be a low point in blood donations, as many people are sick or away from home during the holidays or on vacations. The industry has always been able to weather those sorts of fluctuations until now. Health economists are pointing to a more recent and serious trend that runs the risk of upending the nation's blood economy and with it the emergency blood supply. Karen Brown from New England Public Radio explains.
Most days, the American Red Cross and other blood banks put out the call for donations, and volunteers offer up their veins for the public good. This Red Cross bloodmobile is parked outside a yarn store in Northampton, Massachusetts. A parade of donors comes in and out at a slow but steady pace.
You saying I can leave? I don't have to sit here for 10 minutes?
It's up to
you.
You
feel okay.
Make sure you feel okay. Yes, definitely. Would you like a water, though?
Juice, maybe, yeah.
These donors don't get paid for their blood. But while the raw product is free, the process around collecting and distributing their blood is not. Hospitals pay blood banks for components like plasma and red blood cells, and blood banks use that income to stay viable for the occasional blood emergency, even when donations are down. But over the past decade, medical advances have had unintended consequences on this delicate balance. Darlene Cloutier is lab director at Bay State Medical Center in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Every year over year, we're seeing less and less total components transfused.
Doctors have learned to perform common surgeries with minimal blood loss, so they rely less on transfusions. That means hospitals buy less blood from the Red Cross and other private blood banks. Cloutier says Bay State uses about two-thirds as much blood today as it did 5 years ago, with some coming from its own in-house donation program. Anna Nagurny is a business professor at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. She studies the blood supply and says this drop-off is typical across the country.
The demand has gone down. Okay, so that's a huge issue because various blood service organizations now, they have to reduce their prices.
That may be good for hospitals, which are under pressure to cut costs, but it's not so good for blood banks. Nagurny says nationwide, between 2008 and 2014, blood bank revenue fell from about $5 billion to $1.5 billion. Ziggy Stepyarkovsky is president of the American Association of Blood Banks.
We believe this creates a very urgent situation.
Stepyarkovsky says a drop in blood bank revenue has led to staff layoffs, less money for research and development, let alone maintenance.
Think about it this way. If you don't have money to replace your equipment is getting older and older. So therefore, on a very basic level, you start to see older equipment which is going to fail more frequently.
Many blood banks have merged or consolidated, which may help with short-term budgets, but Stepyarkovsky says it doesn't get at the root of the problem, namely a payment structure that allows blood to be treated like any other commodity.
Under normal circumstances, you would think that blood industry would just sort itself out, yes, as a market force. We don't believe that's going to happen. We don't believe it's going to happen without exposing our society to potential very high risks.
For one, you can't stock up on blood. It's perishable. It lasts on a shelf between 5 and 42 days, so it's tricky to collect just enough to fulfill the orders from hospitals, but not so much that it gets wasted. And with the downsizing of the industry, Anna Nagurny of UMass worries that if there's a sudden demand for blood, say a natural disaster or terrorist attack, blood banks won't have the capacity to collect it in a hurry. Plus, new viruses like Zika both reduce the supply of safe blood and raise the cost of testing it.
And then you get times of great need, for example, like the holiday season. And it's really, really challenging, especially now in the winter season, because if you have a cold or the flu, you're not supposed to be donating blood. So that also decreases the supply.
Last year, a Rand Corporation study confirmed the flux and uncertainty in the blood economy, recommending more investment by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to create a sort of blood safety net. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Brown.
And Karen's story comes to us from the New England News Collaborative. A new biography of Henry Clay is out today in paperback. Clay is the man Abraham Lincoln called the man for whom I fought all my humble life. During 50 years of public service, Clay served as a congressman, a senator, and secretary of state. Historian Harlow Giles Unger argues that Clay was America's greatest statesman. When we spoke in 2015, I asked Unger to tell me more about Clay because many Americans probably don't know much about him.
It's too bad they don't know because he was perhaps the greatest statesman in American history and certainly the greatest speaker in American history who brought order out of bedlam in the House of Representatives and created the modern House of Representatives with the Speaker as the second most powerful figure in the federal government after the President. When he entered the House of Representatives as a young representative from Kentucky, the House was bedlam. Derringer in Philadelphia had just invented a little pocket-sized pistol that everybody could carry in their pockets, and everybody in the House had pistols. Everybody in the House, they were fighting. They'd wrestle and pummel each other, roll around on the floor like schoolboys, then go outside and shoot each other in duels. Henry Clay himself fought two or three duels and narrowly escaped death. He was a courageous man from the frontier and brought order by asserting himself with his gavel and with his personality. He had a unique personality. We've had figures like that in our history, Eisenhower, Lincoln, Washington, Roosevelt, whose force of personality bring people together, people with opposite interests, and these uniters, these compromisers. Clay was called the great compromiser in his day. These great compromisers show people with conflicting interests the common ground, because in the United States, our nation is built on and based on compromise. We all have different interests, but we have to make sacrifices individually for the collective good. And that's what Henry Clay basically invented.
And you say that in the decades before the Civil War, Henry Clay preserved the Union, even saved the Union.
Absolutely. There were five major compromises in 1920, the famous Missouri Compromise, another one in 1833, 36, and 1850. These great compromises preserved the Union by bringing North and South. North and South were bitterly divided between the slave states and the anti-slavery states, the so-called free soil states. They were bitterly divided, ready to go to war with each other at times. And Henry Clay held them together and showed them how the common good would allow them to stay in the Union and fulfill his dream and President Monroe's dream, President John Quincy Adams's dream of this great Union stretching from sea to shining sea, using its resources to become the world's richest power. And that was Henry Clay's dream. And he fulfilled that by holding the Union together during the first 50 years of its existence, when any breakup would have allowed the world's great powers at that time, Britain, France, and Spain, to send troops in divide and conquer us.
Well, you say 50 years. The interesting thing about Henry Clay is he was in power for a long time, served
he
under
was.
10 presidents. He was the House Speaker, and then he was the equivalent of today's Senate Majority Leader.
That's correct. He had a personality that somehow drew people to each other, even bitter political foes, to show them how important the common good was for all of them. And it outweighed their personal or even local interests.
But when it comes to the Civil War and keeping the Union together, it is worth noting that Henry Clay was himself a slave owner. How did he balance that with the efforts to preserve the Union?
He was a slave owner, but deeply committed to abolition. The problem we had in that day was that slavery was a state issue. The state of Kentucky had laws that not only permitted slavery, it made it a crime to emancipate a slave. But he fought nationally and became a leader of American Colonization Society, which was aimed at freeing slaves and sending them home to Africa.
Henry Clay died in 1852. How did the nation react? Because it really was unprecedented what happened.
Unbelievable. He was the first person ever to lie in state under the rotunda of the Capitol building in Washington. He then was taken by train, draped in black, for the people to mourn his loss. The train went to Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, by steamboat up to Albany, with people lining the shores. Cannons boomed. The people cried as he passed. He got on to his bier was put on a boat on the Erie Canal, and he went all the way obviously to Buffalo, then by boat down to Cleveland, then by train from Cleveland down to Cincinnati, and eventually to Lexington, Kentucky, where he was buried. Wow. And mourned by the American people, as no one had been mourned since Washington himself.
That's historian Harlow Giles Unger. His book, Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman, is out today in paperback, and you can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
Public health officials are concerned about a recent surge in bird flu infections in China. This is not the bird flu that made headlines in recent years, the H5N1 virus. This is a different strain called H7N9, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has put it at the top of its list of pandemic threats. Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases and public health for our partners at STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication, and Helen joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Eric.
I feel like we hear about bird flu every year. How is this strain really different or more troubling?
Well, one of the ways it's more troubling is that it seems to be more effective at infecting people. It currently doesn't spread from person to person, and that's a good thing. But there are a lot more cases of this particular bird flu, H7N9, than there have been of other bird flus we've seen in the past, for instance, H5N1. Mm. In fact, this winter, there's been quite a big surge in cases. There have been 460 confirmed cases of this infection, which is a third of all the cases that have been reported since it first emerged in 2013.
But at this point, Helen, even with this recent surge in winter cases, the overall numbers we're talking about are still pretty low. What is it about this virus that has scientists and public health officials so concerned?
Well, the fact that it does seem to be able to infect people more easily is always something that would alarm officials. Another thing is that it is changing. That happens always with flu viruses. But this one may be changing in ways that make it more dangerous. For one thing, recently there have been a few reports that it is now starting to kill chickens. Up until now, it hasn't been deadly to chickens. but it may be evolving to become deadly to chickens.
That's bad news for chickens, but what about for human beings in terms of jumping to humans? What's the likelihood of that?
With previous bird flu viruses, there hasn't been a correlation between high pathogenesis and easier infection in people. But it could be, you know, it may not be that people catch it more readily, but if they catch it, they may get sicker.
What about the existing vaccine for this new strain, H7N9? It was made a while ago. If the virus is always mutating, is that likely to be less effective a vaccine?
Yeah, I was talking with people at the CDC last week, and that's what they're seeing. This vaccine was made with a virus that was isolated in 2013, and it's, you know, there are 12 million doses of it in the U.S. emergency stockpile. They check that from time to time against the circulating viruses to see if it's still effective, and what they're starting to see is that the evolution of the virus is getting to the point where that vaccine is really not optimal anymore, and they may need to order new doses of vaccine for the stockpile.
And briefly, Helen, remind us how most people are contracting this flu and how many have been infected in China so far.
Most people get it by having contact with live poultry, presumably in the live animal markets that are very popular in China. And so far, there have been 1,258 cases diagnosed.
And how many of those 1,258 have people died?
I don't have an exact figure on that, but it's around the 32% range.
Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases and public health for our partners at STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication. Helen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Filmmaker Jennifer Crandall has spent the last 2 years traveling across Alabama, asking strangers to read from Walt Whitman's 1855 epic poem, Song of Myself. Here's 97-year-old Virginia Mae Schmidt reading verse 1.
I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you.
The readings are part of a video project called Whitman, Alabama. It explores issues of identity and place. Creator Jennifer Crandall is artist in residence at the Alabama Media Group, and she joins us now to talk about the project. Jennifer, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about 97-year-old Virginia Mae Schmidt, who read verse 1 there.
Virginia Mae Schmidt, I first met in church. I was invited to church by a couple new friends that I had met in Alabama, and they invited me for dinner and a play. Virginia was one of the actresses in the play, and she just was ridiculously, phenomenally present and amazing on stage, and I was wondering who she was. You know, she never left my mind, so when we thought about doing this project, I said, I have to circle back to her and ask her if she'd be willing to read one of the verses for this project. And she did, and she was amazing, and sadly, she passed away about a couple months after she read, so she actually has never seen this verse, unfortunately.
Mm. Oh, that's sad. Jennifer, you would just walk up to people, tell them about your project, and ask if you can roll tape?
Oftentimes, not every time, but oftentimes we were just sort of, you know, there's one verse, verse 43 that we filmed, which very much is, it's evident where we just walk up to people, pass them on the street, see a scene that we thought was interesting, and then stop the car, pull over and, you know, say, hey, you know, can we just chat for a second, and then unfold what we were doing and ask them if they'd be a part of it and lend their voice.
And most people cooperated, or did you have some people say, well, Whitman, get away from me?
99.9% of people cooperated, and the folks that didn't know Walt Whitman, which was a lot of people, said yes. Even people who said that they weren't sure how they felt about the poem said, you know, I want to be a part of this because it looks like it might be something that might be interesting for me.
Jennifer, why Walt Whitman? I mean, he's a northerner, a white man. Why'd you choose him for a project exploring Alabama identity?
Those are two of the reasons, actually, but there are, you know, a few reasons. First, because it's not just a project about Alabama. I think that it's a project about who we are as Americans. And Walt Whitman offered a poem in Song of Myself, which drew from an extremely deep well of empathy to be able to allow for a real generosity of being and who we are. And I think anyone can sort of find themselves in the poem in some way. And the fact that he's a dead old white dude from New York allows us to sort of bridge the past and the present, text with lives being lived today in the North and the South. And that's why Walt Whitman.
And you saw this 52 stanza free verse poem, Song of Myself, as the vehicle to do that because it speaks to America and who we are?
Yeah. I mean, he wrote this in the first version of it in 1855. But the idea in the poem is just to talk about, you know, the diversity, not just amongst Americans, between Americans, but within every individual American themselves. It just is a massive canvas to work from and allows us, therefore, to go forward in Alabama and really capture not just a small part of Alabama, but a pretty sprawling lot of people.
Let's listen to a little more. Here's a woman named Miriam Jallo. She's young, shy, dressed in a hijab.
These are really the thoughts of all men in all ages and lands, if they are not original with me. If they are not yours. Oh, sorry, I forgot it's the second line. If they are not yours as much as mine, they are nothing or next to nothing.
You spoke to all kinds of people from different races, ages, and politics. Tell us about Mariam.
Mariam was, at the time that we filmed, 14, and just this amazing light. But she's an immigrant from Guinea. Her family's been living in Birmingham for a while. And we filmed in her high school with some students that were in the background doing their thing. We weren't orchestrating them in any way. But yeah, just a wonderful young woman from Guinea who's now part of Birmingham in Alabama.
Visually, this is very beautiful. You get to see Alabamans in their homes and rural parts of the state. How did you imagine marrying the epic poem with the visual elements you were gathering out there?
For me, you know, it was very much about showing people in their elements, despite the fact that we were asking them to do something that was slightly outside of their normal day-to-day. So we would ask them, what is a place or an activity or a meaningful space for you where we could film you reading this poem so we could give people more information about who these folks were that were reading the poem. Also, you know, showing off a little bit more little pockets and spaces of Alabama along with the voice of the person reading. And I would also sort of say that for us, it really wasn't about making this look beautiful. I think we can overdo that sometimes in our filmmaking and focus a lot on the technical and aesthetic aspect of something. We really wanted to make people comfortable so that while they were reading, we could capture moments that were sincere and real, in the midst of their reading.
I really like the Sullivan family, which read verse 16. Tell us a little about this family before we hear some of that.
The Sullivans. It's an emotional one for me. I was in Mobile, Alabama, in a Vietnamese restaurant tucked away in a small part of Mobile, and in walked the Sullivans. And Kathy is in her early 40s. Her daughter is in her mid-20s at the time, Sam. And Samantha is half Vietnamese. I'm also mixed, like Samantha, Asian and white, and so I was drawn to her. Mm. And we just started chatting, and they said, "Sure, you know, you're welcome to do this." Once I explained the poem to them, and they were not a very well off family, but just one of the most generous people I've ever met. And when we filmed, Brandon is Kathy's nephew, who also lives with them because Kathy's sister died.
It's a struggling family, for sure.
It is. Yeah. It's absolutely a struggling family. And, you know, it's just a really interesting microcosm also of America. You know, Samantha being half white, half Vietnamese, her mom being white. And Brandon, you know, she said, "We're not even sure what Brandon's mix is because my sister died. And we didn't learn that from the husband before he sort of left our lives."
Let's take a listen.
"I am of old and young, of the foolish as much as the wise, regardless of others, ever regardful of others,
maternal as well as paternal, a child as well as a man.
Stuffed with the stuff that is coarse and stuffed with the stuff that is fine. One of the nation of many nations, the smallest the same and the largest the same."
Since filming that verse, Kathy, the mother, has passed away from lung cancer, and we did not know at the time. None of them knew at the time, as far as I know, that she was sick. There's a line also in that verse where she talks about being paternal as well as maternal. And, you know, she's currently raising, without a husband, her daughter, Samantha, and Brandon, her nephew. And so the poem is, it means a lot to me for various different reasons. These people became very important to me, Kathy and Samantha and Brandon, and then to find out that a new friend that you had made had passed while you were sort of working through this and editing the piece, it was pretty difficult to go through, you know, for everyone.
That is difficult. Jennifer, what do you see as the ultimate goal of this project, and do you think you achieved it?
Fundamentally, first and foremost, it's really just to have people get to know each other a little bit better. I know that that sounds potentially cliche and maybe a little bit too basic, but I think that we've really had a difficult time learning how to talk to people and get to know people and have conversations with people. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to highlight the South in a way that sort of says this is part of who we are as Americans, and find a way to film it and bring those stories forward so we find, hopefully the audience will find itself wanting to engage with these people's stories a little bit more. Do I think we've achieved it? I think that's really a hard thing to answer.
Well, you've started a conversation and you've channeled Walt Whitman. It's a big achievement in itself.
Let's just see where it goes from there.
Jennifer Crandall, creator of Whitman, Alabama, a video montage of Alabamans reading Walt Whitman's 1855 poem, Song of Myself. Jennifer, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Bless my
And you can see more of the project at our website, hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
For the first time as president, Donald Trump is probably pretty happy with the media today because his speech last night is getting positive reviews for the most part. The Washington Post said Trump seemed muscular but measured. The New York Times said he appeared restrained and serious. And NPR's Ron Elving called the speech Trump's most presidential performance to date. Joining us now to talk about this and some of the other stories involving the press is NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with that reaction. What do you make of the reaction from the mainstream press? And is the bar too low so that all the president has to do is look more presidential and not attack people and he gets great coverage in the press?
Well, this is part of the theatricality of the presidency, is how you perform in, the State of the Union address, or in this case, this joint address to the joint houses of Congress. And, you know, the press at times is hungry for ways in which they can appear to be or be, in fact, somewhat validating and positive toward the president's performance. It's been a tough weeks for those who want to be able to show to their audiences their even-handedness. And I think that there's a very human reaction in the press to try to do that. I think that's what you've seen here. You know, the real question is not simply is there too low a bar. You know, Trump is being in some ways judged against his own performance the past year and a half, but also whether that's accompanied, as it was at places like The Washington Post and NPR, with serious looks at how factual some of the assertions that were presented in this more appealing and palatable address. And I think in that case, there were a number of shortcomings from the president. But nonetheless, I think it's fair to say this struck more of a presidential tone that people who aren't purely Trump supporters could rally behind.
And we remember that it was just a few days ago, at the end of last week, that Trump and the press had a very different interaction. Sean Spicer, the press secretary, held a press gaggle and excluded reporters from the New York Times, CNN, and other media organizations. And there are reports that that approval for that came straight from the president.
Yeah, I think that that President Trump seems happy for there to be retribution as CNN chief Jeff Zucker said to me a couple days ago in an interview, you know, clear retribution against news organizations that he sees as unsympathetic or actually hostile. And, you know, if the president of the United States is saying this in public appearance after public appearance, you can imagine the White House press secretary feels some pressure to show that he's going to be on board and try to do that as well.
But can he do that? There are questions about whether he crossed a legal line by excluding some news organizations from that briefing.
You know, there are questions about whether you can use taxpayer-supported resources, in this case the White House press shop, in such a way that seemingly is a reaction to their exercise of free speech. I think it's not – you know, I think it, legally in principle, I think there is some claim there. I don't think in practice there's many ways to enforce that. I don't think you're going to see that taken to court in the Supreme Court anytime immediately. But you have a number of news organizations wrestling with whether or not they should honor some sort of boycott of events at which people are turned away simply for tough coverage. And increasingly, you're seeing major news organizations, Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, and others saying they won't deal with that. I just got off the phone with ABC News. They're saying they support pushback against such practices and probably would ultimately not participate if there's going to be continued retribution against some of their colleagues.
And do you think that it'll happen again? Do you think Spicer will do that again?
I think we're going to see retribution for negative or tough coverage in all kinds of different forms. It may not take that exact form. You know, I think that there are ways in which Spicer, the president, can shut people out if they want to. You know, President Trump has not given an interview to CNN since May or June of last year,
right,
just before his convention. That's a form of retaliation as well, but not one with any legal issues.
Well, he hasn't given an interview to NPR at all, so we don't know whether that's retaliation or whatever, but he's, of course, welcome to come on anytime.
We're pushing for it.
We're pushing for it. David, one more thing I want to ask you about. Your thoughts on what happened at Fox News last week. Remember the controversy a week and a half ago when Trump seemed to suggest there was a terror attack in Sweden on a night when there wasn't. A few days later, Bill O'Reilly on Fox News had a guest on his show who was ID'd as Nils Bildt, a Swedish defense and national security advisor who pushed the same narrative about Sweden as Trump. Here he is.
There is a problem with socially deviant activity. There is a problem with crime. There is a problem with areas or hotspots of crime, be it in Malmö, be it in Gothenburg, Stockholm, or the suburbs thereof. And these things are not being openly and honestly discussed.
Now, it turns out that that guy is not connected to Sweden's security establishment at all. And O'Reilly has said he shouldn't have been booked. But tell us more about this. And is it common that people put guests on who are not the people that they say they are?
You know, it's not common. It was such an egregious moment and about an issue that was so much in front of the public that O'Reilly stepped forward and apologized and said it was wrong, which is not something you like that you expect to hear out of the mouth of Bill O'Reilly. Cable news has a lot of time to fill, and there have been folks who have been trotted in front of the public and in front of cable hosts who have not met the billing and the promise of their things. This is very unusual for it to be that stark an example, however. And in the case of Fox, it's always in one direction. It's always either in support of folks that they like or against the folks that they're criticizing. That's exactly what happened in this case, somebody who seemed very supportive of what Donald Trump had to say.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.